good morning, everybody. Hey, first things first, I have such an appreciation for our veterans, and we as a church do as well. And if you don't mind, I know you don't want necessarily attention drawn to yourself, but if you don't mind, if you are a veteran, could you stand so that we could tell you thank you and let you know our appreciation for you? So if you're a veteran, please stand. Thank you very much. Thank you. I think it's just a great, we should be appreciative every day, but the sober reminder, I'm glad we have a few days a year, just to remind us to stop and take a minute and say thank you. And so we do, knowing that that what we get to do so often is an appreciation for you guys. And I hope if you are a veteran or you've got a family member who is or a child who is or whatever, I hope that you will know that there's some part of us that recognizes every time we meet, every time we walk around in freedom, that we're doing so. That is a way of saying thank you to you for your service. So again, thank you guys. Okay, a couple of family announcements. We talk about sometimes as staff how, you know, Sunday morning service is all these different things, and sometimes a little bit of what it is like Thanksgiving dinner, in that we come together and it's the one time we're all together, and so we talk about certain things a little bit. And so this is one of those, and this is a little bit of family business that we want to pass along, make sure you guys hear. So, and I know some people have been waiting for this. If there is an open parking space, please park there, not in the grass. That is it. It's rough on the grass to get parked on week after week after week. And I know the mindset for many of you is like, hey, I'm helping, I'm creating an empty space for someone else. That may or may not be true, but when you get here, if there is an open parking space, please park there. And also, some of you are just like, you have a truck, and it just like when you have a truck, you want to park on the grass because that's what trucks are for, right? It's because I can, which again, I fully appreciate. But if there is an open parking space, please park there. If there's not, well, then, you know, what are you going to do? You just do the best you can. But if there is one, please park there. And then whenever possible, as we continue to grow, it's kind of fun, our church, our leadership board, our executive team, our pastors, as we discuss these things, it's really fun to be messing with and being challenged by and having difficulties that are all around growth. So these are good problems to have. These are the kind of problems we want to have. It's exciting. but making some adjustments, because we still have a few hundred thousand dollars left in the Faithful Next Step capital campaign that we're in that we need to be raising. So what we don't need to be doing is taking some money aside and having to build parking in the short time that we've got to finish that off. So instead, these are some things we're asking that would help. Also, carpooling would help. And so I'm speaking to you, teenagers. You need to ride to church with your folks, if at all possible. We need to start doing as much of that as we possibly can so that families like mine, which have come, we only have 7 members, and somehow I think sometimes we've had 5 cars here. So we need to, as much as possible, try to avoid that. Would all help. Again, these all help us postpone the inevitable of how we're going to handle and deal with the growth that we've had. We've had very healthy growth from 2022 when our numbers finally caught back up with COVID, with pre-COVID numbers. We've had very, very healthy 10% growth every year, 2022 to 23 and to 24 and to 25, which is great. It's still good growth, and it allows us to respond to that. But since June, we've had 25% growth. And so we're gonna start seeing some great, shall we call them, symptoms. Just these are some things that will help us respond to that. That's the culture of scooting in, filling in spaces. These are all cultural changes as we have had, you know, more and more. If you have ushers who come and point, scoot in, just scoot. Like, these are the things that are gonna help us. Again, I'll take them. They're the best. These are great problems to have. So we're excited about it. Okay, so now last week, Daniel, by the way, I realize we have a little bit of an issue. We're teaching in the New Testament, and I have to say Paul, and then I have to clarify. I mean Paul McKenzie, our executive pastor, not the Apostle Paul, right? Or vice versa. Well, now I've run into, we're going through a prophetic book, and we now have someone on staff whose name is Daniel. And so I've got to also do the same thing. So Daniel Smith, the pastor who last week preached, he made an excellent point that I think is worth repeating. And then I'm going to comment on one other little thing here. But Daniel made this really great picture for us, which I will steal from now on, and as soon as I can get away with not mentioning that it was from Daniel, I will do that. But I know you would catch me if I did that. I'm just kidding. That's not my style at all. The exact opposite. But to say, he had this great picture of imagine if the first time, you know, you for the first time you're with your spouse or your or whatever, and you have the song you experience for the first time. So in the way that like now, after 30-something years of marriage, there are certain songs that I hear them and they send me back in time. I'm able to remember this. This is, you know, its significance, you know, during our, you know, at our wedding or at when we got betrothed or when we're dating or the birth of our children or all those different things. It reminds me of all these memories, and it's really cool. What Daniel Smith pointed out last time was that prophecy is probably a lot like that in reverse. It's like the very first time you hear that song, you remember the future. You now are, God gives you the vision and you remember something that hasn't happened yet. You are reminded of, it's like you hear that song the first time and you see those early dates and you see the getting engaged and you see the wedding date and you see the birth of your children and that's what it would be like. It's a fascinating way of understanding this and I think worth mentioning. Now, sorry, that being said, this is second service. And so I also have to pay off something from Daniel's sermon. You remember last week Daniel referenced the fact that Kevin Garrity was praying in the midst of the strength and peace of the recognition that even though his wife had been re-diagnosed with cancer and she had been told the amount of, you know, you just don't have much time left, and this all this scary thing, and the staff had come around and we'd all prayed, and many of you knew about this and had prayed. What Daniel forgot to say by the end of the sermon was, she is now in complete remission. So just thought we would, Daniel was like, I can't believe I forgot to say that. So just to let you guys know that little piece of information too. But this picture, this beautiful picture of this, so what we've been seeing so far, this buildup, chapter 11 and 12 of Isaiah are these beautiful these beautiful future pictures, these future memories, if you will, of the divine good graces and blessings of God bringing a new experience, a new existence to humanity, to his people, this new city with its new creation and all this, the beautiful things that are going to be experienced as we talked about. So that's coming. Like that's part of what we've seen coming, and we saw that in chapter 11 and 12. Now, but when we get to 13, there's a break. We don't know how long a break it's been. There's been a break since 11 and 12, since Isaiah's prophecy. But here we're in, and starting in 13, we're going to get a whole series of these oracles. It may be how your version of the Bible says it, an oracle to Babylon or an oracle to different cultures, and there's going to be a bunch of them, several chapters worth, and I'll figure out how to teach through them in the new year when we get there, because they're pretty redundant. They kind of go over the same material, the same messaging, just for different populations, so we'll work on that. But for now, understanding there's been this break, days, weeks, years, we don't know, and these new oracles have now come about. So this oracle, this word oracle, it's a tribute, a burden. God has now laid something on Isaiah, like it's a message that he's got to deliver to this culture. He's got to let them know. And so this is like a warning cry, and he's going to start with Babylon. So it's a warning cry. Hey, Babylon, listen, I've got a message for you. And you don't want to miss this message. That's what it's going to be. It's about one of the many birth pangs. So we talk about the day of the Lord. There's a final day of the Lord in which God brings about justice. He brings about peace. That's what we looked at 11 and 12 and several other chapters before. But now this is an oracle of a minor version of this establishment of justice. And the first place he's going to target is Babylon. Chapter 13, starting in verse 1, the oracle concerning Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz saw. On a bare hill, raise a signal. Cry aloud to them, wave the hand for them to enter the gates of the nobles. So this is a warning. We've got a perfect picture of this in a modern movie that I'm going to show you in just a second. But this idea of except in that case, it's someone sending out a signal asking for help. This is a signaling out of a signal to warn them that an enemy is coming. But so that you have this proper imagery, although this is certainly dramatized, this is fiction, but this concept, so if you will. That even in my first viewing of this, as cool as it is, as someone who hauled lots of firewood as a kid, all I could think was, man, someone's now got to bring a whole other load of firewood up there. That wood's been there 400 years, and now someone's going to have to bring some new wood up there. Now, obviously, this is fictionalized, it's fantasy, it's dramatized. I don't know how you would actually pull it off exactly the way they're showing it. I love that he's waving in addition to setting it on fire. And now we've got, you know, snow-capped peaks that have been, somebody's been hanging out up there on that rock for 1,000 years, I guess, waiting for this moment. Anyway, dramatized, absolutely, but this is the correct picture. This picture of a hilltop that has a warning fire, and this warning fire is there. So guides who are many, many miles, and who knows how many miles, away from the city of Babylon, God is telling them, you might as well go ahead and light those signals now, because an enemy is coming. The enemy is on his way. On a bare hill, raise the signal. But notice how even the army is getting closer. At first, raise the signal. Then it is cry aloud. And finally, it is wave the hand. This is warning that the army is coming closer and closer. And of course, in the movie, Rohan will answer. In the real life, what's going on here, behold, your enemy is coming. So you better start preparing now. Who are these? Verse 3. God says, I myself have commanded my consecrated ones and have summoned my mighty men to execute my anger, my proudly exulting ones. Now, again, for the Hebrew audience, those two words, mighty men, that's got with it all kinds of significance. This probably immediately brings to mind for them the most famous of the mighty men, the King David's mighty men, his picked, hand-picked guards, those who strike fear into anyone of mere mortals who know them, who've ever heard of them, who's ever studied them. In this language, these are his, quote, set apart ones, his consecrated ones. Set apart for what? For this. He has set apart this kingdom to bring about his wrath and his justice to the world, which is wild because, remember, he set apart Babylon to bring this same kind of justice to Assyria. But he's also set up someone else to now bring justice to Babylon. And by the way, if it makes you nervous, the thought of God saying, hey, I've got an enemy, and I've set them apart just for this day, if you're like, that's kind of a scary thought, it gets worse. These are his exulting ones. The Hebrew word here, aliz, the ones who rejoice, the jubilant ones. They're coming to execute his judgment, and they're writing happy songs about it. You may have heard, if you know history, that the Spartans would measure their enemies, how cowardly their enemies were, by how much the tips of their spears shook as they stood in formation. Spartan spears were perfectly still. And in fact, if you've never heard this, Spartans did not go into battle with a war cry. That's, if you ever see it in a movie done that way, that's an error. Spartans marched into battle steadily while singing. Is there anything that would be more intimidating than that? And these enemies are showing up, marching towards your city, and they're singing happy songs about it. These are the Persians and the Medes. The Medes are, like we've talked about, the Philistines. These are the Vikings. These are the Scotsmen. These are the Klingons. They love to fight, right? This is what their idea of a good time. The Medes are all about this, and the Persians are being led by a man named Cyrus. I'll introduce you to him in a minute. So the happy songs are coming, and they're not happy for Babylon. Verse 4, the sound of a tumult is on the mountains as of a great multitude. There's massive noise coming from the mountains. The sound of an uproar of kingdoms, of nations gathering together. The Lord of hosts is mustering a host for battle. Now, again, now for our geography nerds, there are no mountains near the ancient city of Babylon. The nearest mountains are 100 miles away. And God knows this. And he's saying, the armies are so vast, that you will hear the tumult of them while they're still encamped in the mountains 100 miles away. And that's barely an exaggeration, if at all. The armies of Persia are massive, as we're going to see. They took people from every nation of the world to gather. And this is not some mass of barbarians. It's an organized host ready for battle, marching in formation, and they're coming. They come from a distant land, verse 5. From the end of the heavens, the Lord and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. So I think it's time to properly introduce you to who this fearful army is. So I want you to remember, Isaiah is writing probably somewhere between 740 and 700 B.C. 740 to 700 B.C. And for those of you who don't remember this from school, you count backwards when you're in the B.C.s, right? So we talked about the fall of Assyria at the hands of the Babylonians and others. But now what's going to happen to those Babylonians? God has now promised to send an army, a foreign army, from a long way off to defeat them. If by chance you were here in 2020 when we went through, we walked through the book of Daniel, you will remember this. In around 539 BC, so 200 years-ish later, Cyrus, after Isaiah prophesies it, about 200 years later, Cyrus and his general Gobryas the Mede marched on the city of Babylon. Now, according to one historian, he had an army of at least 200,000 men. It's hard to represent that in our brain. It's too big a number for us to really understand. They tried in the movie 300 to show the concept of an army that stretches and creates dust all the way back to the horizon. From horizon to horizon to horizon, you see an army this large coming. And they come like that for days. They continue to march in like that. These massive armies of hundreds of thousands of men. Cyrus had gathered soldiers from all over the world. Every race and creed now reported to him. He had conquered the entire known world outside of the East Asia. He had conquered everything else except Babylon. Now, Cyrus had been a warrior and a leader since his youth. And many believe, based on the writings, that he actually had a very dramatic-looking army. That they intentionally were very colorful and bright, as you can see in this artist's depiction of them. That intentionally they were bright and colorful because they were there to party. This for them was a circus act. They were there to have a great time. That's what war was for them, is they couldn't wait to come. You get so many stories of this Persian army throughout history. The infamous line at Thermopylae when the head of the army of Persia said, "Our arrows will blot out the sun." That's probably not an exaggeration. Now, of course, the Spartans, being the Spartans, said, "Good, because we prefer to fight in the shade." But that's big talk. Of course, the Spartans could carry it off. But despite how we see this, Cyrus had defeated enemy after enemy after enemy with his army. And by the way, at first, he did it almost always radically outnumbered. He was that good a general. Now he had absorbed those armies and absorbed those armies and absorbed them. Now he had developed an elite corps of mounted archers that no one could beat. And war chariots, these famous war chariots, they're depicted in the movie Gladiator. But in what they looked like, these war chariots, notice the scythes sticking off the wheels on the side, the blades that stuck off the wheels. These massive chariots rushing in on you and these blades spinning as they're coming towards you. They were undefeated. He had conquered the entire world outside of Asia except for one place, and that was Babylon, and everyone knew he was coming. Now, Isaiah had prophesied he was coming 200 years before, so everyone knew he was coming. He marched. In a week, his army had taken the entire region of Babylon except the city itself, except the capital city. I'm going to talk in a minute about the second-to-last battle before the city falls. This massive battle that he has against the armies of Babylon in a certain city where they absolutely devastate everything. But the many people of Babylon have pulled into their walls and they feel totally safe in their walls. Now why? Why do they feel so safe? Well, one, they knew for a couple hundred years if they were paying attention, but certainly they knew Gobryas and Cyrus were coming. So they had stocked the city of Babylon. They had filled every crevice with food. They probably had 3 or 4 years minimum of food that they had stacked up. They also had the river Euphrates, which ran right through the middle of the city. They had walled gates on each end of it, so that walls and gates on each end of it, so that the water flowed under and through, but could not, but people couldn't come that way because of the river. The Euphrates is a massive river, like the Mississippi. And so they knew they were totally safe. The armies of Cyrus would have to camp outside for 5 or 10 years to starve them out. And no one could do that. So they weren't worried. They knew that he would eventually have to leave. So here comes Cyrus and his armies. The problem is, God warns them, you shouldn't feel safe. Now, you may have grown up like I was, being mistaught things about the city of Jericho. I remember there's even a song by Carmen that referenced this. The idea that Jericho had these massive walls around it. Walls so thick you could race chariots around the top of the walls. That's an error. That is not correct. That was always about the city of Babylon. Almost everything we learned as kids in Sunday school about the city of Jericho was actually almost direct quotes about the city of Babylon. Jericho's walls, by modern standards, would not be very impressive. Even by the standards then, they weren't that impressive, but they were too impressive for a group of ragtag Jewish people who had just come wandering in. Any wall at all was going to be unstoppable. Just very quickly, so you'll know, historically, so that Jericho had this retaining wall that was holding the city up on all sides. It was too steep to climb. So even the retaining wall would have made it almost impossible for the Hebrews to take it. Then there was a wall that stretched straight up from there. Then a wall that was probably 10, 15, 20 feet high, which the people of Israel, they didn't have siege machines. They didn't have catapults or any of that stuff, so they couldn't take it. So, of course, they march around it at God's command. Well, what we do know is when the city of Jericho was uncovered, not that long ago, was uncovered archaeologically, what they discovered was, and I know you'll be all shocked by this, but that the wall had fallen, the wall itself had fallen, and in falling had created a ramp that allowed people to just walk up the retaining wall into the city. So the wall itself actually ended up working against the people of Jericho. That was Jericho. Impressive in its time and for its location, but nothing like Babylon. Babylon may have had walls so thick you could race chariots around it. That's more likely. So they feel safe, and God says, you're not safe. Verse 6, wail for the day of the Lord. There it is, one of these grand days of judgment. The day of the Lord is near. As destruction from the Almighty, it will come. Therefore, all hands will be feeble and every human heart will melt. They will be dismayed, shocked. Pangs and agony will seize them. They'll be in anguish like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at one another. Their faces will be aflame. Behold, the day of the Lord, there it is again, comes cruel with wrath and fierce anger to make the land of desolation and to destroy its sinners from it. We'll talk about desolation here in a minute. And unpack that a little bit. But I was most troubled by the word cruel in this. There's no context in which cruel as assigned to a person is a good thing. You could say there's a time for wrath. There's a time for judgment. There's a time for whatever. But there's really never a time for cruelty among anyone. And you'll notice, it's tough, but notice it is not the Lord who is cruel in this passage. It is the day of the Lord which is cruel. So we know what it means when a person is described as cruel. What does it mean when a day is described as cruel? The Hebrew word akzari, which means what we think it means. It means without mercy when it's assigned to a person. So what does it mean when you assign a word like that to an event? Obviously, it's going to mean something different. Probably the way that is meant here is it is a perfect filter. Nothing escapes this day. All will be judged this day. There will be no exceptions. Maybe that's the word we need. This will be a day in which there are no exceptions for the people of Babylon. It just means unsparing. No one will find escape through some kind of special merciful clause. This birth-paying day is coming, one of the days of the Lord, when the unbalanced scales are balanced. Even though they should have known it's coming, by the way, somehow in the midst of this, they're going to be surprised. How do you get surprised when you've stored up years of food, and you have a river running through your city, and you're behind walls, and there's an enemy army out there? How do you get surprised at that point? Nothing should be a surprise, right? Babylon the Great by the way, was also Babylon, the great persecutor of others. The nation of Babylon was cruel in this general, in the specific sense, as in its leaders were cruel, its armies were cruel, they were devastating people. There's debate over who deserves credit, for example, for the invention of crucifixion, but it is probably the Babylonians who invented crucifixion. And you have to be a cruel people to invent forms of torture that are as sophisticated as crucifixion is. Her prideful people will somehow be shocked to discover that their wealth and their education and their pride will not protect them. Somehow in the midst of their joy, they will find themselves in agony. They'll be surprised to discover that the only way they can see each other is by the light of flames. But how? How could the city of Babylon fall? The grandeur of it, it's impregnable. Look at this. I've already edited this quite a bit. Run the video, if you will, of the city of Babylon. There's a computer generated, and it's a much longer video because it starts with the outer walls. This is at the inner walls, at the inner gates. And so this massive city surrounded with these giant walls and even internal walls and gates and structures like this, and all of these would be filled with food and protection and weaponry and all those different things. Of course, a representation of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which no one knows exactly what they looked like, but there's a depiction of them. I think Ginger's teaching about those in her history class right now. So this is one idea. I don't know how back then they would have gotten water, that much water up that high, but hey, who knows? Nebuchadnezzar was pretty brilliant. And then it's going to sweep over to the great temple to Marduk, which is probably the inspiration of the Tower of Babel, would have been the initial creation of this temple and this giant pyramid to Marduk, where they worshipped him and all types of different features. But notice the scale and scope of this massive city. It's so huge. Now, we're going to pause right here because this becomes the magic trick. Now, again, if you were here for Daniel, you already know about this. But here's what happens. What happens is as Gobryas and Cyrus have this city encircled, They leave the army there to hold the siege, and they send thousands and thousands of troops upriver. And what those thousands of troops do is they begin to dig into the ground and create, literally with human labor, lakes and swamps, just giant places where they can hold water. And then they begin to divert the entire Euphrates River into these lakes and swamps and other side rivers. The entire Euphrates River, and they wait until the moment seems right to them, and they break out these final barriers, and the Euphrates River starts going down. Now, because of the pride of Babylon, they had not lowered the gates into the entrance to the river or the gates along the river banks. They were so sure of their safety that they hadn't put those protections in place. And the river Euphrates overnight got low enough to where the men of the armies of Persia, 200,000, march into the city of Babylon in water knee-deep. And they take the city almost without the shedding of blood. No one knows they're there. They're suddenly inside the walls. They go and open up all the gates. And the only people who die are the leaders. It's a really impressive. God is sending Cyrus. But could even Cyrus take this city? That's how he takes it. They march into the city. Verse 10 picks this up. For the stars of the heavens and their constellations will not give their light. The sun will be dark at its rising, and the moon will not shed its light. I will punish the world for its evil, and the wicked for their iniquity. I will put an end to the pomp of the arrogant, and lay low the pompous pride of the ruthless. Hold on to that idea of pomp, arrogance, ruthless. But I have to, just for fun, just to see if it would work, I checked with ChatGPT. We know literally what day and what year this happened. It was recorded that well, the fall of Babylon. So I checked with ChatGPT, what was the night like that night? Now, sadly, it couldn't give me weather systems. I was like, come on, surely it can. No, it couldn't do that. But it could give me the status and the state of the stars and the moon. And that was a relatively moonless night. The moon did not come up till very, very late in the morning on that. So it would have been a very, very dark night over Babylon. On top of that, the historian Herodotus tells us that there was a massive festival going on in the city of Babylon. Now, who would be arrogant enough, pompous enough and dumb enough to host a giant party in the city of Babylon while the armies of the Persians, the most powerful army in the world, is literally outside your gates. Well, another historian, a guy named Daniel, tells us about it. Daniel chapter 5, verse 1. King Belshazzar, there's our idiot. And if you remember, that's kind of his nickname. You have Nebuchadnezzar the Great and Cyrus the Great, and you have Belshazzar the moron. That's how he's thought of through history. No one liked him. King Belshazzar made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords and drank wine in front of 1,000. Belshazzar, when he tasted the wine, commanded that the vessels of gold and silver that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, it's actually probably his great-grandfather, had taken out of the temple in Jerusalem be brought, that the king and his lords, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. So not only is he having a party, but he's going to offend every god that he possibly can while his city is surrounded by the greatest army of all time. Then they brought out the golden vessels that had been taken from the temple, the house of the God in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Immediately, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace opposite the lampstand. And the king saw the hand as it wrote. Now, we unpacked this pretty in depth when we studied Daniel. This may be the lampstand. Literally, the menorah taken from the temple may have been there. And so the angel, whatever angel guards the lampstand, apparently got a message from the Lord. I don't know how you've ever pictured it. I think when I was a kid, probably because of how it was drawn in the kids' books, is that there was a giant hand that appears and starts floating over to the wall and writing. Maybe. It doesn't say. But after studying it, I came to the conclusion that the angel who stood guard by the menorah actually was given an instruction. And his hand, just like from coming behind a veil, sticks out into the created physical realm from the invisible realm. And this with a hand, he starts writing there opposite the menorah these words, min, min, tekel, parsen. And he writes them on the wall. Now, what are those? They are three Hebrewish words. Daniel is the one who's going to interpret them down a few verses. This is the interpretation of the matter. Min, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Verse 30, that very night Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed. This happened at the festival talked about by Herodotus. It happened that night, the very same night that the Euphrates River was lowered to the point where the armies of Persia could come in. And they killed King Belshazzar, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom being about 62 years old. You may remember that I think the title Darius is given to Gobryas, who was in fact a Mede and was about 62 years old at the time that this happened. Now this prophetic message about the city of Babylon is going to spread out. All of this is going to happen 200 years after this is written. A flash even further in the future, like Daniel's picture from last week when Daniel Smith talked about, they see how I have to do that? So Daniel Smith, the pastor, not the prophet, had clarified the idea of this. I'm remembering our first dates, and now I'm remembering in advance our wedding day. Well, this is like that. It's further down the path of memory, and we see this concept of desolation being played out. Verse 12, I will make people more rare than fine gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore, I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken out of its place at the wrath of the Lord of hosts and the day of his fierce anger. God makes really good use of the Hebrew apocalyptic language here. The heavens tremble, the earth is shaken. We have similar language. It'd be like saying, and the consequences of this will be earth shattering. Babylon, the greatest city from the past, is at some point going to be devoid of human life. You'd literally be more likely to find gold laying on the ground than to find people. Who's going to live there? Nobody. Verse 14, like the hunted gazelle or a sheep with none to gather them, each will turn to his own land, and each will flee to his own land. Again, this prophecy looking into the future from the time of Isaiah. Listen to this. This is kind of weird. See if you can catch what was weird about this. Whoever is found will be thrust through. Whoever is caught will fall by the sword. Their infants will be dashed in pieces before their eyes, and their houses will be plundered, and their wives ravished. Behold, I am stirring up the Medes against them, who have no regard for silver and do not delight in gold. Their bows will slaughter the young men. They will have no mercy on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes will not pity children. Now you go, that seems strange. Now, maybe you're thinking the same thing I did. That seems strange. I thought Babylon fell without hardly anyone even being killed. And that's correct. That's what happened. But I actually think, after doing a little extra research, I think this is prophesying the battle that happens just outside of Babylon. So before Babylon is encircled, the Babylonians sent out their army to try to stop the Persian army. And they met at a certain city just a few miles from the city of Babylon. And at that city, the Persians met. And it looked like the Babylonians should have easily defeated the Persians. But Cyrus, obviously under the command of the Lord, much less his own military genius, totally fools the leaders of Babylon. And he encircles them and decimates them. And anyone, the entire city that the battle is fought through and around is decimated. The Medes and the Persians kill everyone. This is right before Babylon is besieged. I can summarize it. And notice how God is telling him, I'm sending not just the Persians, which is bad, but the Medes. They don't even pillage places because they don't care. They're not there to win. They're there to kill. That's who the Medes are. That's what they love. And so this gets summarized in one quote. This one historian, Pierre Briant, said, this victory was followed by an immense haul of plunder and the massacre of anyone who attempted to resist. Anyone at all was killed who was caught. Anyone who tried to flee the battle was killed. Only those who fled directly into the city of Babylon survived for a little while. It was a massive destruction of life. Everyone the Persians could catch, no matter what they killed. And also, part of why I think this is talking about the buildup to the actual city of Babylon is in the text itself. Their bows will slaughter the young men. They will have no mercy on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes will not pity children. Verse 19, and Babylon, as if the city is independent of this. Additionally, and Babylon, the glory of the kingdoms, the splendor and pomp of the Chaldeans, will be like Sodom and Gomorrah when God overthrew them. It will never be inhabited or lived in for all generations. No Arab will pitch his tent there. No shepherd will make his flocks lie down there. But the wild animals will lie down there, and their houses will be full of howling creatures. There ostriches will dwell, and wild goats will dance. Hyenas will cry in its towers, and jackals in the pleasant palaces. Its time is close at hand, and its days will not be prolonged. So again, this is 700. This is being promised in around 700 BC. And sure enough, from the time this begins, once Babylon falls to the Persians, the city begins its decline. By our standards, it's a slow decline. By our standards, the fulfillment of this prophecy takes a long time. It's not until 800 AD that the city of Babylon is finally, completely, and finally, utterly emptied of human life. The last people leave the city in 800 AD. Now, for us, we go like, that's a long time to fulfill that. But we also have to remember, we're always dealing with the timetable of Almighty God, for whom, as Peter says, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like a day. This is very quick from God's perspective, from his eternal perspective. It's coming. It's going to happen. It's 200 years before the first thing hits, and then you're going to have those several hundred years before zero, and then 800 years going the other direction. But long before that, the place was desolate. Very few people lived there. The final people were left in 800 AD, left the city of Babylon. And this is what blew me away. And then the city of Babylon was lost. The ancient city of Babylon, the greatest city in all of human history by many standards, was literally lost, buried under the sand. And no one knew where it was. It was not dug back up until the 1800s, 1,000 years after the last people left it. It did not exist anymore as anything but buried stones. It wasn't until around the end of the 1800s. There's a picture, one of the earliest pictures of its excavation in 1899, as people went down and began to dig out the great and mighty city of Babylon. They're still excavating it. In Middle Eastern countries, it takes them a very, very long time to excavate stuff because of the nature of the way the Muslim religion sees ancient artifacts like this, and then the resources that it takes. I remember being in Cairo, and the guide asking me about what would this place look like if it was in America, and I was like, oh, we would have structures that were built all the way up and over the pyramids of Giza, and all these, and it would be air conditioned, and there would be a price to go in and experience it. Like, it would be, everything would be perfectly kept. You wouldn't have guides walking over with a hammer knocking pieces off the pyramid to hand to the people who they were there to, which I watched happen. We would have all kinds of rules and restrictions and a certain number of people every year, and then we'd be all this stuff. We would certainly be doing that if we had a 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000-year-old city in the United States. We'd be taking care of it like that. But for now, you can visit it. Someone after first service came and told me they've been there, and it just is excavated super, super slowly. But that's for over 1,000 years. It has set exactly as God said that it would. So I'd encourage us, church, come, let us reason together. God may not follow the timetables that we think. What he says is soon, maybe to us seems like many, many, many lifetimes. But he will accomplish what he says. When he says he's coming back to get us, the same. Well, it's been 2,000 years. Not long for him, just for us. His promise to bring justice and recompense, and in the midst of this, listen, I urge you, if you do not know Jesus, I urge you to respond to this. In that day, the final that day, his promise to bring redemption and glorification to his children is that promise. His timetables have never been ours. We've never understood them perfectly. But that day is coming. So with that in mind, I'd encourage you to stand. During this time of invitation, our assumption is always that when God's word has been taught or struggled through or wrestled through as we do, that there's ways we need to be thinking and changing and responding in our hearts. It may be different. It's going to be different for how the Spirit leads each of us. Of course, here in a moment when we start singing and the musicians begin to lead us again, if you've been through our welcome home process and you've talked to Lance and others and you're ready to come and join this dysfunctional family and do ministry and church with us, that's when you can come forward and let us know you've been through that process, and we'll introduce you to everybody. For all of us, though, I think we can be ready for a specific but familiar application over these next few weeks. There is a day, and it's coming. It may be tomorrow. It may be 1,000 years from now. Someday, the day of the Lord. There is a conquering kingdom that is coming. I think it's probably we can hear the tumults in the mountains. We can't know when, but we know that it's coming. This is key. God isn't kidding about this. He never has been. Not about the small, the days of the Lord's, or the final one, the day of the Lord. Do you know him? Are you ready? I'm going to have the Apostle Paul. I'm going to read from the Apostle Paul here in a moment, who's going to unpack. It's clearly mirroring this exact same passage. This is clearly what Paul was thinking about when he wrote this. To us. Do we know him? Are we children of light? Do we walk in the light? Or are we still asleep? Are we still drunk? Or are we ready for the day of the Lord? Listen and respond. Come to Christ. Come pray with these up here if you don't know him. And if you know him, confess, repent, ask him to guide you. Open your heart to him. Here's what the Apostle Paul says to his brothers and our brothers and sisters in Thessalonica. In 1 Thessalonians 5, he says, "Now concerning the times and season, brothers, you have no need to have anything written to you. For you yourselves are fully aware that the day of the Lord," there it is, "will come like a thief in the night. While people are saying there's peace and security," it's like the Babylonians, "then sudden destruction will come upon them as labor pains come upon a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. But you are not in darkness, brothers, for that day to surprise you like a thief. For you are all children of light, children of the day. We're not of the night or of the darkness. So then let us not sleep as others do, but let us keep awake and be sober. For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk are drunk at night. But since we belong to the day, let us be sober, having put on the breastplate of faith and love, for a helmet, the hope of salvation. For God has not destined us for wrath, but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, so that whether we're awake or asleep, we might live with him. Therefore, encourage one another and build one another up, just as you are doing." The very words of the Lord.